Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Where we showcase new authors. This is show number 126, and I am your host, Tom Riedel, and today is October 31st, 2022, and soon I'll have on co-host Terry Brown. And a brief intro to today's show, Connie Howell will be with us from Australia, and she has written Perfectly Imperfect, and she'll be along to talk to us about that book in about 15 minutes. Now more about us. Here's where you could find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net. In the blog section and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiedel56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we will get back to you. A special note, we can now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Atmosphere Press is with us, and having hosted the Writer's Lounge broadcast for over 11 years now, Terry and I are very happy to have Atmosphere Press on board as our sponsor. If you're a writer just starting out in this exciting world of writing and are looking to get published, the following message is for you. Then we'll be right back.
Hey there. We're Atmosphere Press, a professional and welcoming alternative to traditional publishing. Founded in 2015 by Austin-based writer Dr. Nick Courtwright, Atmosphere Press is dedicated to getting awesome books in print, while also ensuring that authors retain 100% rights, royalties, and final artistic autonomy over their own work. Atmosphere has published over 700 books in a range of genres, from novels to poetry collections to memoirs and children's books, and our books have received countless starred reviews and book prize honors. If you're an author looking for a true partner in the bookmaking process, we hope to hear from you. Check out our website at atmospherepress.com and consider sending us your manuscript today.
Once again, thank you, Atmosphere Press. Thank you for sponsoring the Writer's Lounge. And on November 14th, upcoming authors on the show in 2 weeks, author Rob Sanborn, this best-selling author, will be back with us on the Writer's Lounge with his book, Painter of the Damned. It's a sequel to The Prisoner of Paradise, which was reviewed by me during his first time on the Writer's Lounge. And on November 28th, 2022, author David Tuno will be with us with his book, Intrepid Spirit. If you are into learning about admiring old Ironsides, also known as the U.S. Constitution, the 200-plus-year-old warship, you'll want to tune in for this one. I'm a lover of history and a good entertaining fictional tale, and Intrepid Spirit delivered beyond what I could have imagined. I hope you'll tune in to these exciting upcoming shows. And the next segment here is one of my favorites, of course, on the Writer's Lounge. We've been doing it ever since 2011. And this is where I get to also introduce my co-host. And this time around, for several shows now, we have been honored to have Terry M. Brown on as my co-host, and she has written Sunflowers Beneath the Snow, and I want to bring her on now, opening up the door here for Terry, and in walking to the table to sit down right now next to me is Terry Brown.
It is Terry Brown.
Even though you happen to be many states away, it feels like we're sitting here together having a wonderful conversation, and we're hoping to do that too with Connie. But you had mentioned that you'd like to talk about something tonight about that follows in the category of writer's topics, and what would that be, Terry?
Yeah, so I read this article the other day, and I was very surprised that the New York Times bestseller list is not necessarily the best-selling books. Like, I would have thought, well, of course it's the best-selling books. I mean, it's called the bestsellers list.
Right.
So, so what was interesting was this article talked about in 1983, William Blatty, he was the author of The Exorcist. He also wrote another book called Legion. And he sued the New York Times bestseller list because he said that his book had sold enough copies to get a spot on the list, and that because it wasn't on the list, then he was entitled to compensation. Well, the New York Times countered and said the bestseller list isn't objective. It's editorial content, which is protected by the First Amendment, and the New York Times won. And it's because there are a lot of different ways to count a number one book. You know, is it number one in paperback? Is it number one in audio? Is it number one in hardback? Is it, there's all of these things that can change how they count number one. So it just got me to thinking, you know, as an author, like, who doesn't want to be on the New York Times bestseller list? And then you find out, well, it doesn't necessarily mean what you think it means. So then my question was, well, then what does constitute, you know, making it? You know, so if it's not being on the New York Times bestseller list, then what is it?
Right, and I would think also maybe they should change that name. It's not a bestseller list, like you say, because it doesn't come from best sales.
Even if it does come from sales, there's so many different ways to look at it that you don't really know what you're getting. I guess starting sometime, maybe it was in the 60s or the 70s, you know, don't quote me on the time period, but originally the New York Times bestseller list was only hardbacks. Now they do a hardback list and a paperback list. And often those two lists are not the same. There's not a lot of crossover between who makes one list and who makes another. Nor is there a lot of crossover in the genres.
Right.
So I just thought it was just very interesting. So, you know, maybe getting on the New York Times bestseller list, I mean, of course you still want to, because that's a pretty good indication that, that the book is going to, you know, make you some money. But in terms of being an author, when you realize that, that it's editorial in nature and that they could just choose not to like your topic and not even entertain you for a list, what should count for authors as that thing that you're going for? And I, you know, as I thought about that this week, I kept thinking, well, maybe it's got to be something more internal. You know, what is it that you're trying to do with your book? And if you succeed with that, whether you make a list or not, then that should be enough.
Right, and it's all up to the editors, apparently. And I had continued reading what you had given me here, and it says here, which I found very interesting, because it relates to you and I in what we have written. And it says, as can be seen, nearly a century, the list's two biggest genres are historical and detective and mystery by a fairly large margin. And it says, for instance, historical fiction has declined in popularity. Its peak was in the 1940s, Terry, when about 24% of novels in the data were historical. But the genre dropped to a low in the 2000s when it made up only 10% of listed novels. Now, it's kind of funny. I went to my first book, book club. And I was the only guy there and about 15 women, which was a little uncomfortable. But what I also found out was a lot of these opinions that these women had about this book that I was reviewing was way off from where I had it. I had it at a 4-star and they had it at some of them said 2 or 3-star. But it was funny that most of them talked about future books that they wanted to read, and they were almost unanimously talking about wanting to read historical fiction. So, of course, I had to plug Sunflowers Beneath the Snow. But I found interesting. but I find it interesting that historical fiction kind of took a dive with the New York Times bestseller list. And it just
doesn't ring true. What was interesting, though, was we see that through 2000, right? That's where that stops, that the information stops. So in the last 22 years, it potentially could be going back up.
Right. Right.
You know,
we don't know
that. But my point then is I too have found the number of especially women that I speak with love historical fiction. That seems to be the genre that women like, especially if there is a historical fiction that has a bit of a love story to it. Not necessarily like true romance book, but something that has a little bit of you know, eventually the guy gets the girl kind of thing with it, and it's historical fiction as well. And the women seem to love it, and yet it doesn't make this kind of list.
Right, right. Eesh. I don't know. I'd really like to take a poll on how many authors really know what consists of making it onto the New York Times bestseller list.
People don't know. I was shocked.
Yeah, I was too. I really was shocked. And I'm also shocked of the review, you know, a different topic, but sort of along the same lines, because we're all trying to sell our books. But I was also shocked at the way the reviews are tabulated over at Amazon and whether they accept a review or they deny a review based on your relationship to the person who's reviewing your book. If it happens to be a spouse, they'll kick it off. or if it's another family member, cousin, uncle, aunt, or whatever, and they will kick it off, which I don't think is fair.
Well,
because
and sometimes they'll kick them off, and you don't even know why.
Right, right.
Because even yeah. I've had a couple that I had, and then they went away, and they're not there anymore, and I don't
right.
know why. You know.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of reviewers that have agreed to review my next book and have told me I can review it for Goodreads, and I can review it for Barnes & Noble, and I can put it on my blog, but I can't put it on Amazon because they banned me from reviewing books because I reviewed too many.
Wow. Wow. I certainly
would be in the... There's a whole lot of stuff that goes on in the background that, you know, it isn't just as simple as people like your book and review it. Or you
right.
sell enough books and you get on a list. Yeah.
Right. Wow. Well, we'll talk about that some more at another time. I want to get on to the main event tonight, and that is with talking with Connie Howell, who wrote Perfectly Imperfect. I want to remind everybody out there, if you'd like to call in and talk to Connie or me and Terry, you can do that at area code 914-219-0868. Once again, that's area code 914-219-0868. In my review of Perfectly Imperfect, Perfectly Imperfect may have once been categorized as a self-help book, but it is so much more than that. The author injects the themes of a memoir into this very interesting and thought-provoking book about the lessons of life and what we should take away from our existence here on our continued earthly journey. She uses troubling examples of her own life and her growth through the years to reach out to us and to explain that we don't have to strive to be perfect. We can be loved just the way we are. The concepts are easy to understand, and following each chapter, there are questions that you can ask yourself that will help you in your efforts to understand the person that you really are and to accept the person that you are. The author reveals some disturbing life-altering situations that she went through that so many of us can relate to, and this helps us to connect with her and to learn how to move on from it all. When I picked up this book and began to read it, I realized that the title doesn't really do justice to explaining the content because there is so much more here that the author delves into. Without mentioning the specifics, Connie Howell touches on all the essentials of human growth, imperfections, and the complete essence and what it means to be human. One of my favorite quotes in the book is this: remember, we are not humans having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. I have learned that a good book, whether it be fiction or nonfiction, will cause you to think about the content long after the last page is read. This is one of those books. This is a must read. And now I would like to welcome Connie Howell to the Writer's Broadcast and let her take a seat all the way from down under, as we call it, Australia. And I think down there in Australia right now it's 9 a.m. So, Connie, I hope you got the sleep out of your eyes, and I hope you're ready to go.
I am. Thank you, Tom. And hi, Terry. And it's actually 10 o'clock.
Okay.
10 o'clock.
Because we went into daylight saving not long ago, so we went forward.
Oh, and we will do ours next week.
Oh, will you?
Yeah.
It gets very confusing, doesn't it?
I know.
Very good.
I know, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, if you've got a cup of coffee there, Connie, go ahead and take some sips. And before you do that, though, tell us about yourself. Where you live in Australia, and what drives you to write books such as Imperfectly Imperfect?
Well, I live in the Blue Mountains, which is west of Sydney, and it's a beautiful place to live. There's a lot of creative people up here. I used to live near Sydney with my husband, Walter, and we just decided we wanted a quieter life. And it's said that the mountains draw you up here, and that's what I feel it did, because when I came up here, that's when I really started to settle down to become a writer and settle into discovering more about myself and what I wanted to do. I write about myself. That's the only thing I really know. I don't think I could write a novel. I wouldn't know where to begin. But I just felt moved to write about the imperfections of life. And I'm very skilled in the imperfections, as you know, having read my book.
Yeah.
I've blundered through life a lot. But I was talking to my sister the other day, and she and I were talking about it, and she said, you know, it's been a tough life. And I said, yes, the thing that's got us through is a sense of humor.
Yes,
and I
absolutely
think that really helped. Yeah, laughter is really the best medicine.
Yes,
it is.
And many,
it is.
Many
if
of
you
us,
can laugh
have...
at yourself or laugh at your situation, it makes a huge difference.
Yes, I think it's really good to do that sometimes.
It sure does. Many of us have histories that mold us into who we are today, both the good and the bad experiences we learn from. And you certainly moved on in life from some very traumatizing events. You bravely mentioned them in your book. Can you talk to us about some of those experiences from back then, and what's the process of turning the bad experience into something more manageable that we can live with and learn from?
Yeah, I've always been driven to get better. You know, I had a troubled childhood, and I carried a lot of anxiety and fear, and that carried on through previous marriages. And I just had this inner drive to just know myself better, and I just knew there was something better than anxiety. And I did have anxiety attacks for about 5 years at one stage, and it was very, very troubling. I was very lucky that I've always been able to go and get help. I've never been afraid to seek out help. And the one thing I learned about anxiety and panic is that the worst fear is the fear of the fear.
Uh-huh.
And so through getting help, I've actually learned to sit with fear. It doesn't mean I never get afraid, and I still have little trembly attacks every now and again. But I've learned to sit with it and not be totally consumed by it. And I've found out really that fear can be a good friend, because it teaches you to really go into yourself and see what's really happening. And I learned through reading a lot of books myself. I've always been an avid reader. That there are lots of things you can do, and just being present and knowing that these things will pass. And I think this goes for all of life. Whatever problem comes up, it will pass. But we get very stuck in it sometimes and can't see a way out. But if we're just patient and know that we're actually stronger than we believe we are, we can get out of most things.
Yes. Boy, I got to tell you, you have such a soothing voice. And, you know, you could talk for hours. I could listen to you. You just soothe me. So that's really nice. But Terry, do
well,
you
have
anything?
She has a lovely voice, and then you and I are both enchanted with the accent. So that does not do anything at all.
Absolutely.
It's a very hybrid accent, because it's still very English, but I'm quite Australian too, so it's a bit of a mixed breed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, it's lovely. It's like Tom said, we could just sit here and let you just talk and talk. You could say anything you wanted. We would just keep listening.
You might regret saying that, Terry.
Yeah. So in your book, you wrote, I let my imagination and love of magical stories of fairies and Santa Claus and any other mystical stories that I read fill my mind with anything other than daily reality. So that was like a coping mechanism for you. What did you, as a child, what did you read most? And then did you have any adults in your life that supported your quest of reading?
Yes. I don't know if you've ever heard of Enid Blyton and the Famous Five, but as a child, I read a lot of those things. And I read anything about mystical things and fairies and anything otherworldly. I was very, very afraid of anything supernatural, so I didn't go there, although my stepfather used to read supernatural novels to us, and it used to frighten the hell out of me. But, yeah, I did. I used to have nightmares.
And this is Halloween.
Because
this
now
is
I'm...
Halloween, too, up here.
I know. How appropriate.
Yes.
Yeah, I just loved reading. I really did, right from a very early age. So anything, you know, about mystery, I loved mysteries. Anything to do with, I love stories about King Arthur and Merlin. I think they're amazing. I still do. Anything fantasy.
Did you read any comic books?
I did. We used to have the Beano and the Dandy. And I remember those. Yeah, you probably never heard of them. I mean, because I grew up in England and they were the comic books.
Yeah, oh, okay, yeah. I never heard of them. I was more into Superman and Spider-Man. So.
Well, now I'm into that. I mean, I absolutely adore the Marvel movies.
Yeah.
Any superhero movies. I think, you know, they're just amazing. Lord of the Rings, all that kind of stuff. I just adore.
Yes, yes. You talk about learning to not be a victim and that it can change the people around you. How so, and can you give us an example of that?
Well, as a victim, you're in a certain mind frame. And what happens is a lot of other people take on roles. They might take on the role of rescuer, a confidant, might even be a critic. And when you start to change, become more empowered, that kind of rattles their chain a little bit. It destabilizes their role in your life. And, you know, some people don't like it and they fall away. And other people can go with it and adapt with you. But because I believe very much in the energy body, we're not just a physical body. So I often talk about when your vibration changes, which is when you change your consciousness, then other people have the opportunity to either rise to the same vibration or they go out of your life. I'm trying to think of an instance. I can't bring one to mind at the moment. I'm sure there's been plenty. But it's been a lot of people go out of my life.
Right, right.
And you know, not regrettably.
Right. Terry, I think you could relate to
absolutely.
Much of that.
So I spent 14 years in an emotionally abusive relationship, and I didn't want to be divorced again, and so I hung in there trying to fix something that, you know, was not fixable by one person. But what was interesting when you say that, I had a great therapist who was working with me, and she did not tell me to leave him. She probably should have, but I think she knew that if she did, I would have walked away and not listened to her anymore.
Yeah.
So instead, she helped me become a stronger version of me. And
yes.
As I did that and felt less like a victim because I was becoming strong, the arguments between he and I got worse. And it's like the vibrations, like you said, they were no longer in sync with one another.
It
wasn't too long until we did part ways, and I think that makes a lot of sense to me, that idea that, you know, I kind of quit playing the victim. I became me again.
Yes.
And that didn't work well for him.
Terry, that's just reminded me, that's exactly how I was in my second marriage. I didn't want to be divorced again either because I felt it would have been a complete failure. And as
I got stronger, exactly the same. Yeah, like a big letter on your head, you know, the big scarlet letter, you know, and there I am, divorced. And then I read where you said that you've never planned to get married again. Well, neither did I. And I found my person as well. So it's just amazing. I feel like you and I are kind of like soul sisters.
I think it
sounds like it.
Yeah, I connected with that too. I read that and I go, oh my gosh, there's Terry again. Because we've had authors on before and she's always got a connection there somehow with them. And I think, boy, that's pretty remarkable. Now, you talked about, you know, the supernatural and stuff, but you didn't really talk too much about religion. How did that shape you as a person as you grew up?
Look, I tried religion. I really, really did try. One of my sisters was quite religious, and I went along to her church for a while. I got the call. But I just found that for me it was just very restrictive, and, you know, the thought of being damned to hell if you sin was just, it just really frightened me, and it just didn't sit well. And so I moved away from the church. And I'm not, you know, against people being religious and what they believe, but for me, the thought of a vengeful God and if you've sinned you go to hell for however many years just doesn't sit right. So I leave religion alone, but I'm very spiritual. I believe in a super consciousness, whether you call it God, universe, great spirit. I don't think it cares what you call it. There's definitely a super consciousness that created all of us. But to me, it's a loving presence that never, never condemns us, never turns away from us. And, you know, my idea of life is that we come here, Earth is like a school, we come here to learn lessons.
Yes.
And whatever we do, good or bad, and this is going to upset a lot of people, is part of the learning experience. So I don't see it as sinning, I see it as we make mistakes, that's how we learn. But we're always, always loved, and we're never turned away from.
Yes,
that's my
yes.
take on it.
Yes, I agree. Just a short related story to that. I was a 12-year-old and went to Catholic Church, and they told me in the Catholic Church as a 12-year-old that if I ate meat on Friday that I would go to hell. Well, I went out and I had a Big Mac on a Friday. And ever since I ate the Big Mac, they were telling me, you're going to hell. And then finally I realized after several years of being traumatized by that as a 12, 13, 14-year-old, I finally realized that the God I believe in wouldn't do that to me.
Yeah.
Over a Big Mac. And so
it
nobody
is very traumatic,
it.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It was very traumatic. And I ended up leaving the church. I got yelled at once for showing up too early for confession, and I didn't close the church door, and the priest yelled at me when I left the church. He listened to my confession, but then he yelled at me for leaving the door open. So I never went back to confession after that because of the impact that his behavior had on me. And, you know, I respect all religions, but I'm more like you. I consider myself more spiritual, more in tune to the universe, and I do believe in God, but I believe it could be anything.
Yes,
like you say, it's a connection to our higher power, whatever or whoever that may be. But anyways, you talk about how we have choices in your book, and of course, you know, I've made some terrible choices in my life, and I think that's a huge component of how we live our lives. What we choose to do or not to do at any given moment can literally change the outcome of our lives. Kind of reminds me of the scene in The Wizard of Oz when Dorothy meets the Scarecrow and they have to decide what side of the fork in the road they're going to travel down. How can we be smart in making the right choices in life so we, like Dorothy, decide to go down the right way instead of the wrong way? And, of course, as you had said, that maybe there are no wrong ways. It's a learning experience. But in this experience that we live.
I think that's really true. If we get unhooked from having to make the right choice, because that is just terrible. We put ourselves through so much stress trying to make a right choice sometimes. I think if you are very intuitive and tune into yourself, then you're going to go down the right path. But even if you don't, it's just the diversion, and you're going to learn something anyway. So I don't see choices as good or bad. I just see them as learning experiences.
Right.
And even the ones we call bad, then haven't we moved forward from having that experience? That's how I see it.
Yeah, I tell my children all the time, I said, you know, most of us, I mean, maybe not everyone, but most of us try to do the very best that we can do given the situation we find ourselves in and the tools at our disposal.
Mm.
And so sometimes those decisions that you look back on and say, well, that was a bad decision, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was the best decision given the circumstances that you had and the knowledge that you had and the experiences that you had. Now that you've been through it, you know, you'd pick something different. Well, good. That means you learned something.
Absolutely.
But that we kind of do our very best at any given time. I know as a mom, I mean, I can look back and there are a bazillion things that I, you know, can point out and say, I didn't do that right and I didn't do that right and I didn't do that right. But I did, I know I loved my children dearly and I did the very best I knew how to do. And it wasn't always the very best, but it was the best that I had.
My philosophy is if you could have done better at the time, you would have.
Yeah.
So we do what we can at the time. And yes, we can look back and say, oh, that wasn't really good. And I'm the same, Terry. I made terrible mistakes with my own children. But I couldn't have done it any differently given the belief system I had and the programming I had.
Exactly.
I loved my children very much too.
Well, if when you look back and can say, oh, I would have changed that, then it proves that you learned something.
Yes. And that,
you know,
I
if
think,
you look back and there's nothing you would change, then you didn't learn very much from all of those things that you did, you know?
That's true. Absolutely true. And that's the wonderful thing. You've actually learned something from making that choice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we put ourselves through too much stress trying to do the right thing all the time. I mean, I think we, you know, need, obviously, to aim for doing the right thing. But when we make a mistake, instead of berating ourselves and doing self-flagellation, we just have to get on and say, okay, well, I learned something from that, and that's good. And by making that choice, we might have enabled someone else to learn something as well.
Well, and I look at, like, my 14 years. I look now and think, why didn't I get out of that long before 14 years? You know, well, I couldn't.
No.
I would have. You know, like if I could have, I would have done that, right?
Absolutely.
But what I did learn was I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about what it means to live with someone who's abusive. I learned a lot. I've talked with a lot of women, and I've been able to help them see things they might not have been able to see because I've been in that situation. And so, you know, or I recognize abuse. I can recognize an abused woman so quickly that it just would knock your socks off. And I'll say something to someone and they'll say, oh, no, they have a great relationship. But it's like, don't think so.
And that's a great thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And so you can kind of almost like keep an eye on people and let them know, hey, if you need to talk, I'm here.
Yes.
And would I do it again? Like if I knew, would, you know, no. But then if I knew, I wouldn't have had to go through it to learn. So,
Exactly.
Yeah, you can't play
and,
that game.
You know, if I hadn't had the experience I've had, I wouldn't have written this book and I wouldn't be talking to you.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's all got a purpose. We can't see it at the time, but everything has a purpose. Do you think?
Yes, it does.
Oh, I agree.
Absolutely. And I have to say, too, that I had gone through severe depression. I was homeless for 3 years in the early 90s.
Wow.
And I sometimes think back, somebody says, well, you know, if you could have done anything different to not be homeless or be in that situation, would I have chosen to not be in that situation? And my answer is quick, no. But I want to live. I learned from that experience. And I'm a much better person now, I believe, from having that experience than I would have ever been. So it was a gift to me. It's hard to see it at the time, but it was a gift nonetheless. But another component to making choices. Talk to us about self-respect. How important is that?
Oh, my goodness. I think it's one of the most important things we can do. Without self-respect, no one else will respect us. They'll just treat us like dirt. So I think self-respect to me is really coming to understand and accept all of your flaws so that, you know, you don't have to be perfect all the time. Nobody can be. That the learning process is up and down. It's like a wave, that we're going to make mistakes sometimes and we might regret them, but it doesn't mean we're bad people. And so self-respect is like the cornerstone of who you really are. Because if you, I mean, there are many people will abuse us, but to abuse ourselves is the worst form of torture, I think. So
yeah, and
to me, it's
not helpful.
Oh, it's not helpful
at
all.
No, it's completely not helpful because, you know,
no.
Like I think about people who, for instance, are trying to lose weight. And they eat something that later they say, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that. And so they call themselves ugly names. You know, you're just a fat pig, da 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 da.
Yeah.
Does it change anything? Does it help them lose weight? No, it doesn't. That idea that we're going to talk ugly to ourselves and that's going to somehow change what we do is crazy. You know,
well,
the way that we do change is to learn to love ourselves, you know, to like give ourselves a little bit of grace and forgiveness and say, okay, so maybe that wasn't the best thing, but you know, it's okay. We can move on from here.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to do that, that's where change comes from.
Exactly. And again, if you could stop doing it, you would stop doing it. But like overeating is one of the symptoms of deeper things. It's how we feel about ourselves. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are going to help us not have self-respect because they don't have any either.
Exactly.
And it's very much a power thing, isn't it? People don't want us to succeed because that means they might be at risk. So it's really, really hard to change and have self-respect because there's a whole lot of people around us that aren't going to support us in that. I mean, there are a lot. I mean, I have some really good friends, and I think this is what you have to do, is you have to pick your friends really carefully who will support you no matter what. But it's rare.
Exactly.
And I found in my experiences being bullied in school and other instances in life that once I acquired self-respect after I went through treatment after those 3 years of depression, I found it was more of an automatic response when somebody would treat me badly. I didn't think about it or just say what I needed to say. It just came quickly, and I said, look, you don't treat me that way. And I would say that to a boss. I would say that to a coworker, or to a significant other or a family member. It's automatic. I had, several examples I could give you, but I won't do that because I'll probably reveal to people that I've talked to in the past. So I don't want to do that. So
the names have been changed.
yes. I was gonna give you an example. It was gonna come out, and I thought no. If that person is listening, he's not going to be too happy with me. So I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave it right there. So,
Tom, did you find it difficult in the beginning? Because people ask me all the time, saying no and standing up for yourself is really, really a difficult thing. But people often say to me, oh, you're so good at it. But it's always a constant effort to do that, to stand up for yourself. Did you find that?
Yeah. I'll give you a little bit of an example, and I wrote a book which was not meant for mass publication. It was just family and friends. It was very large. It was 700 pages. So I used to say, if you didn't like to read it, you can use it as a doorstop. But I met a psychiatrist in that book who helped me in the 3 years, and she was instrumental in giving me back my life. And she had said to me several times, I know you better than you know yourself. And I thought, laughed at that in the beginning. And then I realized Dr. Burton knew me. Well, there was a time when I had to decide on going to college or to go to a group session, which she put on for us. And I loved the group sessions. I was learning a lot from that. And I decided I have to go to college and get my books and to meet with a counselor, but it was conflicting with this time that I had arranged and planned to meet in this group. And Dr. Burton's rule was you don't miss a group or you're out. Well, she was very, she promoted me going to college. She thought that was great and promoted me and said, you have better IQ than you think you got, sir. And so when I told her, I was mad. I was so mad at her for not letting me in the group that I punched my door and put a hole through my door. And I came in to meet up with her the next day. And I told her I wanted to meet with her, and I was going to tell her off. And I got in there, and she sat there very sternly looking at me across the room. And she says, you have something to say to me, Mr. Idell? And I said, yes, I do. I think you're a very stubborn, unfair woman, and I don't like for the way you treated me on the phone when you yelled at me. She looked at me, and this big smile came across her face. And she says to me, Mr. Idell, congratulations, you're no longer a patient.
Wow.
And it was at that moment it hit me, and I started crying. I still, when I say that story, that's what happens. But ever since then, like I say, you know, the self-respect has been there whenever I've been in a bad situation. But, it's amazing when that happens, when that little switch flips. But
what's interesting about that is I know that's what I want to do. I often get lost in the moment. So something will happen and it's an hour later and I think I should have said something or I shouldn't have let them talk that way or I'm better. People don't walk all over me anymore, but there's still that part of me that wants to please so badly that I don't want to say something. What if I offend you?
Yeah.
You know, like what if me sticking up for myself offends someone? And so that's something that I'm still working on.
Well, look, it's a work in progress. I'm still a work in progress too. I don't think you suddenly just get it and it's, you know, it's done. I don't think so either. Every opportunity, and I don't know, Terry, but I think women tend to be emotional, so sometimes we get the emotional hit before we can think about what we really want to say.
But
I'm very good now. My friends would tell you this. I do tough love, and they're still my friends, which is a testament to them. And there's only three of them, but they're, you know, that's all I need. But I don't listen to stories anymore because it's not helpful.
Right.
It might be, you know, it might be helpful to some people, but to my good friends, if they're going down a funk, I just say, you know, I just do tough love and tell it how it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Forgiveness. It's sometimes very hard to forgive someone when they have hurt us so badly. Anger surfaces, and what's your advice on that?
I think the whole concept of forgiveness needs to be really understood. A lot of people think to forgive someone that's really hurt you or done some horrible things is like being charitable. But forgiveness is for us, for ourselves. It's to release ourselves from the bonds of anger and hate. It really ties us to the person, and who wants to be tied to somebody that's done horrible things to us? It's not a one-time thing. It's you can't just say, "Oh, I forgive them," because that's not real. It takes time, and you might have to keep on doing it and doing it and doing it and working on it. But it actually releases you from those bonds, and so it's not an act of charity. It's an act of self-preservation. That's how I see it. And so, you know, I still sometimes have to work on little memories that come up and forgive them. And if you can't forgive in the beginning, a willingness to forgive is a good way to start.
Right.
So it's not about saying, if I forgive this person, it's letting them off the hook and they've done horrible things. It's not about that. It's about I want to forgive this person because I want to be free of those emotional things. Because anger and resentment and all those really strong, deep emotions hurt you in the long run because they can make you really sick. And if they're not addressed and you go years and years with them, you can get ill.
You can get ill. It can affect how you have relationships with other people.
Yeah.
It can taint even good things going on in your life because there's that you know, you're still got this attachment. You know,
yes.
I tell people that to hate someone is just as strong as to love someone. You know,
yes.
their feelings are as strong. They're different, but they're as strong. And it's actually better if you can find a way to just not care.
Yes, yes.
You know, like you just don't, it's neither here nor there to you, you know?
Yes.
I know with my ex-husband, I'm in stages of forgiveness.
And there are,
you know, I can say things now like, I don't wish him any harm. I don't want him in my life. But, you know, I wouldn't want to see anyone, you know, harm because that would have, you know, too much emotion attached to it.
Yeah.
But to be able to just say, you know, he is what he is what he is and he doesn't affect me is actually way more freeing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Terry, got a question?
So, you know, obviously there was a lot of dysfunction in your family. There's been a lot in mine. How can we break those cycles so that, like, we don't pass them on to our kids and then the grandkids and then the great, you know, these are the kinds of cycles that have been going on for generations. What can we do to start, like, putting chinks in that?
Look, sometimes I think too late. I've already done it with my children.
Yeah.
But what I do now is I've been really honest about, you know, why I was the way I was, the feelings I had, the traumas that I've been through, the help that I've sought. So I think just being honest that life isn't perfect. We're not perfect, that we're learning. Nobody, there's no manual to be a parent. Some people are better at it than others. I just seem to miss out on that particular chink of learning. You know, I mean, I was a kid with kids. And when you've had a lot of trauma in your own life, basically the core of you is trying to keep yourself together at all times. And so you're not always, you know, you can't be there for the kids half the time because, with me, I was inside of myself fighting with myself to try and stay stable. I didn't do very well a lot of the time, but I was really fighting with myself.
Right.
And
right.
So what I do is I just be as honest as I can about, you know, what was happening for me. Not excusing it. Just saying that's, you know, that's what I was going through. I dissociated a lot as a child, and it took a very long time and a lot of help until I realized that's what I'd done and that that's actually a normal thing when you're traumatized, that you tend to split
right.
off parts of yourself so that you can actually go on with life. So,
right.
you
right.
know... blaming ourselves doesn't help. I mean, we all do it. We all want to be better parents and better people, but it's not very productive. All we can do is be the best self we can be now.
I like that idea about being honest. And, you know, I sit down with my kids and I tell them, you know, it's not a good excuse. But the truth is that I didn't know how to leave.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I didn't.
Right.
I didn't know what to do or how to do it.
Yes.
So, you know, like looking back now, I can give you a million things that I could have done, but I didn't know them then.
No.
You know, and that's the thing is I think you're right, just being honest and letting them know, and especially if you see them doing things that you did, and you know that these are things you wish you hadn't, to be able to sit down and have that conversation.
Yes. Isn't that a gift? I think that's a real gift that you're able to do that. My belief about life and children is that, yes, they come to you as you give birth to them or you father them, but they're beings on their own journey. And they've come to learn certain things as well. And so the fact that they're with us as their parents is that they've come to learn through growing up with us.
Right. Right. I tell people all the time that I started my children's once upon a time, but they have to finish their happily ever after.
Yes, yes.
Exactly.
You know, that's not my job. You know, I gave them the start part, and now it's up to them to you know, continue wherever they're going to go. So
exactly, right, because they've all got their own journeys.
Connie, we're getting close to the end here, and this is what we normally call our Oscar moment. Any parting words of advice to anybody out there? And who would you like to thank for your successes you've enjoyed so far in life?
Well, I'd love to mention Deep Read Press, because they believed in my book. The first edition I actually self-published, and I decided after a few years to rewrite it, and they loved it, and I've just so thankful that they loved it. Walter, my
also got other books out there too, right?
I do. They're others are self-published, but the love of Walter, and he has supported me so much in so many ways. I mean, he's my good karma. You know, I went through a lot of bad karma. He's the good karma, and he was worth waiting for. Third time lucky.
Yeah,
yes, that's what I say. I agree.
Terry's got the same thing going for her, too. Yeah. So, Connie, thank you so much for being on the Writer's Lounge. We really enjoyed it. It was quite a session. And, well, let's keep in touch, because like I told you before we got on the air in a comment, is that I could talk to you for hours. So, and
love to,
I won't be able to listen to that lovely voice of yours, and Terry and Al missed out on the accent, but we really enjoyed it tonight. So you have a wonderful day, and Terry and I will finish up our evening here in the North.
Thank you both. It's been such a joy speaking with you. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Take care now.
Thank you.
Okay. Make sure I click the right button, not hang up on Terry. So, Terry, what'd you think?
Here.
What'd you think?
That was excellent. I think that she has some really strong ideas about, you know, how we can go through life in a way that allows us to have some grace for ourselves, that allow us to say, you know, I'm doing the best I can and I'm learning along the way, and that's good enough. You know, you don't have to be perfect. I love it.
I agree. And I couldn't agree more. It's a wonderful show we had. Thank you again for being my co-host. And next time in 2 weeks on November 14th, Rob Sanborn will be back with us to talk about his next book. And we're going to love having him back, because he was a great guest there the first time. And again, Connie Cowell wrote Perfectly Imperfect. Thanks to Atmosphere Press for sponsoring us. And Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen in the eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night and happy Halloween.
Good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface It's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the